Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hello, everybody. We are in the last days, not the biblical last days, but the last days before the SBGAN annual meeting. And if you haven't yet been to Lille, I can assure you it's a lovely place to skip some of the lectures in. I should take that back. That's very naughty of me. Today, we're recording the last SBGAN podcast to be broadcast before that annual meeting, I believe. And we have with us what we in Hungary call egy unikum, something unique, the first, the so far only, of his kind to be interviewed in this series of podcasts, a chemical pathologist, Dr. Tim Morris. Dr. Morris, well, he has a resume like a patchwork quilt, but I mean that in the best possible way. He took all the prizes when he was an undergraduate studying genetics, and then went off to study plant genetics, but said, I don't think so, and spent 3 years as a financial analyst. What a absolutely orthogonal to what I would have thought of as plant genetics, but there we are. Then a second degree in medicine and 2 years on the wards as a junior doctor, and then chemical pathology. We will have to see in a couple of years whether he winds up doing something completely different, completely different from his present field. Today, he's asked us to work through a problem in calcium metabolism, that is, a form of metabolic bone disease, MBD, in children with intestinal failure who are on home parenteral nutrition. His team's findings from Tridimus et al., as published in JPG and Reports, require a bit of background for best appreciation. And maybe we should start by asking Tim to tell us how he would define MBD, metabolic bone disease. Tim, over to you.
Okay, so I would describe metabolic bone disease as when your skeletal homeostasis is disturbed and therefore you have defective bone mineral density. I think that's probably the best way to describe it in a nutshell.
Bone mineral density, that's measured non-invasively for the most part, I believe. There's the word densitometry gets waved about, although I don't really know what that is.
So DEXA, dual energy X-ray absorptiometry, which measures the bone mineral content. It's based on a radiological imaging procedure.
I understand it. There are two different types of metabolic bone disease that are particularly involved with calcium and phosphate metabolism, and those are rickets and osteomalacia.
That's it indeed. So rickets would be deficient mineralization of growth plates and osteomalacia is slightly different. Although DEXA, let me get this right.
As I understand it, you can have osteomalacia if you're a child.
Yes.
As well as if you're an adult. But to be rickety, you have to have an active growth plate.
Yes. So DEXA can't differentiate osteomalacia. But you can also have osteoporosis in children, which is low bone mineral density with history of non-traumatic fractures.
So we go from rickets in kids, with osteomalacia as a part of that rickets, to non-pathologic fractures, and with that you tip over into
Osteoporosis.
Well, what are the contributors to osteomalacia in persons receiving parenteral nutrition? Now, we can leave aside aluminium toxicity. That's I learned all about that in medical school, but that was 50 years ago.
Yeah, whether or not that's the thing is another point entirely, of course. But yes, so we think that the etiology of metabolic bone disease in children with intestinal failure is thought it's combination of inadequate calcium and phosphate provision, but also vitamin D deficiency. They have inflammation from an underlying disease which contributes, and also any medical treatments they may be having. So if they're on steroids, for example, they would have risk of low bone mineral density.
Back to mechanics. If you're missing your terminal ileum, then you're missing the place where you take up your vitamin D, are you not?
Well, indeed so, but it varies. It varies as to which part of the bowel these children are missing, and sometimes they're not missing any. So they might have missing bowel. They might have a non-functioning bowel.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just put missing as a subset of non-functioning then. Many different ways for the bowel not to function, to be sure. Right, then, if I have understood this correctly, all of the contributors, although we haven't gone anywhere near naming them, converge in hypocalcemia.
Well, that's
and secondary hyperparathyroidism as a consequence.
Well, yeah, it's more secondary hyperparathyroidism than hypocalcemia. So the body will try and maintain calcium balance, and therefore the parathyroid gland will release PTH in order to try and release calcium from bone in order to maintain calcium balance. So you're maintaining your calcium in your blood at the expense of your bones.
So calcium levels fall and parathyroid hormones rise in an attempt to jack those serum calcium levels back up again.
Indeed so.
But hypocalcemia and secondary hyperparathyroidism aggravate deficiency of mineralization. And so you move from osteomalacia to frank osteopenia. And then osteoporosis, defined as having broken bones.
Wow. Go on, sorry.
No. You have to remember, I'm a layperson in this field, trying to sum up what I can scramble out of a very senior hippocampus here. What have I got wrong?
Well, yeah, so if you've got a calcopenic state, then your PTH increases, and that normalizes the blood calcium levels, reduces the serum phosphate, and elevates the alkaline phosphatase. Mm-hmm. So you end up with osteoclastic bone reabsorption, mm-hmm. And low blood phosphate levels, which can give you risk of rickets and osteomalacia, if that makes sense.
It does. So parathormone lights a fire underneath your osteoclasts, and then you start to gnaw away. They start to gnaw away at what bone mineral you already have, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if I've grasped your article correctly, you took a cohort of 37 children with intestinal failure who were receiving parenteral alimentation, PN, at home, and you chose home PN, because you could pretty much rely on things to be in good order with patients who were hospitalized. Is that an accurate summary?
Yes.
Okay. 4.5 years then, going a retrospective study, and in 22 of those 37 kids, 60% more or less, you found elevated parathormone levels.
Indeed, sir.
And 5 of those 22 had elevated parathormone levels in 50% or more of the data points that you were able to retrieve.
Yes.
Then comes the flowchart protocol, to which I'm going to have to refer our listeners, cascading from an initial parathormone determination, and over 4 months, whether or not high, normal, or low parathormone levels altered with determinations of calcium and magnesium, adjustments in calcium and phosphate concentrations in the PN being administered, PN parenteral augmentation, sorry, I should have pointed that out before, and a repeat determination of parathormone, which sets you back at the beginning of that cascade. As you were employing this monitoring protocol, parathormone values were elevated in 6 children, and persistent elevation of parathormone was found in none. You recommend for your team that parathormone values and these adjustments in parathormone values, and then determinations of calcium and magnesium, adjustments in calcium and phosphate concentrations in administered PN, and return to the top of the PTH cascade be more generally applied in order to intervene in this sequence before osteopenia, before osteomalacia develop.
Indeed. So I think the important thing is that the PTH is the earliest biomarker that will go up, which suggests a developing calcium deficiency state.
So
that will happen before your phosphate goes down and before alkaline phosphatase goes up. So measuring PTH is a really important biomarker in this cohort.
Well, what is current clinical practice for PTH measurement in patients like the ones you studied?
There's very little in the guidelines that points you towards this. So I think current practice varies. Our team is rather skewed because there's a chemical pathologist as part of it. So I will have input into measuring things that other teams might not do. But there's nothing really in the guidelines specific in this particular field, which is why we wanted to publish this study, really. We thought it was a really important thing to get out there, and hopefully that can make it into some guidelines at some point.
When did you draw a line under your data collection and your manuscript writing? How long before the article was published?
Good question. It took a while to get the paper written and agreed. Probably a year or so.
So that means that the opportunity has been there for more than a year, call it a year and a half, of additional follow-up in your cohort. Have you undertaken such follow-up?
We've not formally done that yet. Although anecdotally, it's very rare that you get a persistently elevated PTH. Obviously, anecdotally, but it is something that we will follow up at some point. Sometimes you get an odd PTH that's high, but it doesn't happen very often, and we can get on top of it quite quickly. Being a lab person, I do like a repeat. I do like to confirm with a repeat. Us lab people don't like acting on one-off results, so I do like to confirm with a repeat, but it's not often that happens now.
Next question,
I think
we're
in a much better state. I think historically there was always this thing historically that the calcium to phosphate ratio in PN should be 1-to-1, and certainly at the time I was getting involved in it, it was fairly adhered to that that's what we did. But in reality, if you adhere to a one-to-one ratio, you're going to develop problems unless you keep an eye on the PTH and adjust the calcium balance in the PN appropriately.
What kind of resonance has the publication of the article brought to you? Have people asked for guidance in adopting the protocol or in following your guidelines?
They haven't, no. I have shared it with some people. So I'm hoping it's out there and people have looked at it and are using it. But no one's asked me about it.
Perhaps this is an opportunity to ask you how frequently one encounters rickety kids on PN.
In our cohort, not really. Because, I mean, what we should say is it's important that this isn't the only reason you can develop. It's not just calcium balance that you can develop metabolic bone disease and intestinal failure. But you get some children have evidence of reduced bone mineral density and some fractures, but that is, but they don't necessarily have a history of high PTH. So we can, it's about reducing the risk that we can reduce, if that makes sense. I think a really important take home message is that if you've got vitamin D, shouldn't be viewed as the savior of all of this. Because if these children, if their guts aren't working and they're relying on PN, then the vitamin D, its sole job is to absorb the calcium and the phosphate from the gut. So if it's not working, then you've got to think of it another way.
You're jabbing at a dead lift button, aren't you? And the lift's not going to go anywhere.
So I think it's important for people to understand that that adjusting the calcium balance in the PN, adjusting as in the molar ratio of calcium to phosphate, adjusting that is really important. And that's not to say that you should happily run with a low vitamin D. You should always try and keep vitamin D replete. But there's a number of children that I've come across who have very replete vitamin D and still have raised PTH because the vitamin D is not doing anything.
Let me diverge a little bit from the topic of the article that you supplied. And let me ask you about those outliers. I'll call them outliers because I can't say that I remember having had to deal with them intellectually. Those children who have evidence of normal calcium phosphate balance in terms of normal parathormone levels as well, and who nonetheless are not mineralizing their bone. What's causing that?
It could be a number of things. I mean, so as I said at the start, underlying disease, inflammation from underlying disease, the treatments they're getting, just generally poor nutrition. So yeah, it's a cohort that's at risk of reduced bone mineral density, at risk of fractures, and risk of bone pain due to the metabolic bone disease. So this is one factor of a condition that's has a spectrum of causes, but it's a modifiable factor, whereas the other factors are harder to modify.
Understood. How often does one monitor bone density using a non-invasive technique, something other than bone biopsy with labeling techniques? How often is that to be conducted in order to identify problems with bone mineralization. Since we can't always rely on calcium, phosphate, and parathormone values to clue us in?
Well, we tend to measure it when the child reaches 5 and then every few years during childhood to keep an eye on it. And if there's a problem, of course, then the child will be seen by the metabolic bone team as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds as if that would not be a bad idea in any of these kids before you send them off to play rugby.
Indeed.
Hmm. I have a number of questions that I'd like to put to you that have nothing to do with this particular topic, but why did you leave the fields of the Lord in plant genetics?
The research wasn't going well, and I just wasn't happy. It's like when a lot of PhDs sort of collapsed, I guess, because things don't work, and things weren't working. I was getting more and more unhappy, and so I had a change.
Understood. But tell me now about that amazing sideways leap into investment banking.
Well, it wasn't so much investment banking, so it was PricewaterhouseCoopers, so it was what was called global risk management solutions, so it was managing IT risk. Yeah, I was just looking for a job, and that looked interesting.
I bet it was. Well, it was 3 years worth of interesting, which is...
It was, although a lot of that was me knowing I was going to go and do medicine and trying to earn some money.
That's practical. And I haven't mentioned this to our listeners yet, but you're also a flute player.
And a fairly
good one.
I'm a baroque
flute player.
In terms of the
paperwork, right? You have all the certificates.
I do. I'm a licentiate to the Royal Schools of Music. I'm a baroque flute player, so the flute as it was 300 years ago.
This is amazing. I've never before met someone we're all handed recorders in primary school, but you're the only one who kept his.
Well, it's not really a recorder.
I'm joking.
Yeah. I describe it as a wooden tube with holes and one key on the end. But it's played out to the side like a modern flute, but it doesn't look like a modern flute.
And with that, we've reached the topic of music. As you know, at the end of these podcasts, we generally ask the person being interviewed if they have a song that they'd like to put forward as representing them, representing the work that they've done. And it's time to ask you now. What would you like to recommend to the folks at home?
Well, this is tricky because I don't like modern music, as you might gather. And trying to think of my favorite piece of classical music was near impossible. So I went at it another way. I thought, what's my favorite thing to play on baroque flute? I decided to go with a suite by Michel Delabar, which was written in 1702, a set of 5 suites, and I would pick the 5th suite of the 5 in his first book. They are of historical significance to flute players because they were the first set of suites or music that was specifically written for the flute, not recorder. So, yeah, the historically significant, I particularly do like to play the 5th suite, and I'm sort of, I particularly specialise in French music from around the turn of the 18th century, so it ticks a lot of boxes, so I'll go with that.
Thank you. It's going to be a window into a new world for many of those listening. I'm confident of that. Hey, yeah. You out there, those listening, reducing metabolic bone disease burden in intestinal failure children on home parental nutrition. JPGN Reports, 2023, November 6th, Volume 4, Number 4, and The bibliographic details are out there in the online version of this podcast. Tim, one last question.
Yeah.
From I'm going to ask somebody who's inside the guild, is it flautist or flutist? Which do you prefer?
Flautist.
Flautist.
Yeah.
Flautist. Now, there's a take-home message for me. Thank you very much for being our guest, and happy playing.
Thank you.